EMWD's Water District Board of Directors meeting, this being July 17, 2019, time being 9 a.m. Randy, could you lead us in the pledge, please?
Sure.
Please join me in the salute to our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we need a roll call? We don't need one. Just Director Slauson is absent at this point. He's expected to arrive around 10 a.m. With that, agenda item one, this is the time and place for anyone for public comments that is not on today's agenda. And seeing no one raise their hands or to speak, we'll have the introduction of guests, please.
Good morning. We just have our team from Webster today.
Okay. All right. Thank you. With that, we'll go to agenda item two, which is a public hearing. 2A is to adopt Eastern Municipal Water District's 2016 to 2018 Public Health Goal Report. Al?
We have a procedure for the public
hearing. I'm sorry. This is the time and place set for a duly written notice public hearing regarding adoption of a report for EMWD's 2016 to 2018 public health goals. I declare this public hearing open and would ask a staff report on the proposed action.
Thank you. Public water system survey board has 10,000 service connections in our support that need to prepare a brief written report in plain language every 3 years that gives information on any contaminants detected above all public health goals or PHD. Adopted by Cal EPA, Office of Environmental Health Hazards Assessment, or OEHA, and the law also requires that where OEHA has not adopted a PHG for a constituent, water suppliers are to use a maximum contaminant level goal, or MCLGs, adopted by US EPA. The purpose of this legislative requirement is to provide customers access to information on levels of contaminant at concentration below enforceable mandatory maximum contamination levels, or MCLs. Provisions in the law require that the public be made aware of the cost to reduce contaminants in drinking water to below the PHG, regardless of how minimal the risk might be. PHGs are not enforceable standards that are based solely on public health considerations. The report that Michelle Harris has provided, she did a great job on that, requires information for those constituents detected in the district water supply at levels exceeding any applicable PHGs or MCLs. Those were arsenic, bromine, coliform, rose alpha, rose beta, and uranium, with a maximum of 6 facilities that were affected. Health risk was cancer, with a numeric risk of 1 in 1 million. Technologies to remediate these were ion exchange, RO, and good zoning. Thank you.
Okay. I would ask the secretary of the board, or let's ask any, do we have any questions about? Okay. I'd ask the secretary of the board how this hearing was noticed.
The notice of the public hearing was published on June 14, 2019, in the Press Enterprise newspaper, which was set the date and time July 17, 2019, at 9 a.m., and placed Eastern Municipal Water District Boardroom at 2270 Trumbull Road, Harris, California, for the public hearing to consider public comment on Eastern Municipal Water District's public health goal report.
Okay. If the Secretary of Board has received any written protest to the report, I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the board.
No written protest to the report has been received.
Thank you. At this time, are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this matter? If so, please come forward to the podium, state your name and address for the record, and present your comments. And seeing none, I will accept a motion and a second to approve the and receipt and filing of the EMWD 2016-2018 Public Health Goal Report.
Approved. Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. This concludes the public hearing. We will now return to the next item on the agenda. Next item is B, public hearing to adopt a proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District approving the collection of annual Wine Country Sewer Special Benefit Area Agreement payments on the property tax roll for fiscal year 2019-2020. This is a time and a place set for a duly noticed public hearing regarding collection of annual payments for Wine Country. I declare this public hearing open and would ask a staff report on the proposed action.
Morning, President Sullivan, directors of the board. November 2013, the district created a special benefit area in the Wine Country area of Temecula and established a special benefit area surcharge in order to spread the cost of construction of sewer infrastructure to area participants. The board authorized a financing program to assist property owners with the payment of the surcharge and certain financial participation charges associated with the connection to the Wine Country sewer system. On July 6, 2016, the board adopted Ordinance 2016-006, establishing the collection of these financing payments on the property tax roll commencing that same year. In fiscal year 2018-19, the district levied 23 parcels for a total assessment amount of $246,177.50. As of June 26, 2019, the district has received all amounts assessed through this method with no delinquencies. 23 parcels will be levied for the 2019-20 tax year for a total assessment amount of $246,177.61. Staff prepared a Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure Financing Special Benefit Assessment Report for Health and Safety Code 5473, which identified each of the parcels to be charged and amortized annual payment. This report was filed with the Board Secretary on June 19, 2019, upon adoption of Resolution 2019-059.
Okay. I would ask the Secretary of Board how this hearing was noticed.
The Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure Financing Special Assessment Report was filed with the Secretary on June 19, 2019. Notice of the filing of the report proposing to have annual Wine Country payments for the upcoming fiscal year collected on the tax roll and the time and place of this hearing was published in the Press Enterprise, a local newspaper, on July 2nd and July 9, 2019, in accordance with Government Code Section 6066.
If the Secretary of the Board has received any written protest to the proposal, I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the Board.
No written protests to the proposal have been received.
Thank you. At this time, are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this matter? If so, please come forward to the podium, state your name and address for the record, and present your comments. Seeing none, there has been no protest made by the owners of the majority of separate parcels of property described in the report, and the board now has the option to adopt, revise, change, reduce, or modify any payments in the report. If no revisions are requested, we are ready to approve the following resolution. Resolution of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District approving the collection of annual payments for Wine Country Sewer Special Benefit Area Financing Agreements on the property tax roll for the fiscal year commencing July 1, 2019. I will accept a motion and a second to adopt the resolution and the associated report.
So I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The resolution that we have just adopted approves of the filed Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure Financing Special Assessment Report, along with the collection of annual payments for Wine Country Sewer Special Benefit Financing Agreements on the property tax rolls for 2019-2020. This concludes the public hearing, and we will now return to the next item on the agenda. Next item on the agenda is 2C. This is a time and a place set for a duly noticed public hearing regarding collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax rolls for the fiscal year commencing July 1, 2019. I declare this public hearing open and would ask a staff report on this proposed action.
In July 2015, the Board adopted Ordinance 2015-003, which established a collection of annual sewer charges on property tax rolls for sewer accounts not connected to the EMWD water system. In fiscal year 2018-19, the district levied 132 parcels for a total assessment amount of $61,030.44. As of July 2nd, 2019, the district has received all amounts assessed through this method with no delinquencies. The district will levy 133 parcels for the 2019-20 tax year for a total assessment amount of $65,055.30. All charges have been calculated in the same manner as non-sewer-only accounts in accordance with the consolidated schedule of rates, fees, and charges. Staff prepared a sewer-only account special assessment report for Health and Safety Code 5473 attached as Exhibit B. This report identifies each of the parcels to be levied as well as the calculated annual sewer charge and was filed with the Board Secretary on June 19, 2019 upon adoption of Resolution 2019-060.
I would ask the Secretary of the Board how this hearing was noticed.
The sewer-only account special assessment report was filed with the Secretary on June 19, 2019. Notice of the filing of the report proposing to have annual sewer charges for the upcoming fiscal year collected on the tax roll and out of the time and place of this hearing was published in the Press Enterprise, a local newspaper, on July 2nd and July 9th, 2019, in accordance with Government Code Section 6066.
If the Secretary of Board has received any written protest to the proposal, I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the Board.
No written protest to the proposal has been received.
Thank you. At this time, are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this matter? If so, please come forward to the podium, state your name and address for the record, and present your comments. Seeing none, there has not been protest made by the owners of the majority of the separate parcels of property described in the report. The Board now has the option to adopt, revise, change, reduce, or modify any charges in the report. If no revisions are requested, we are ready to approve the following resolution. The resolution reads, of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District, approving the collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax roll for the fiscal year commencing July 1, 2019. I will accept a motion and a second to adopt the resolution and the associated report.
I'll move the item.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The resolution that we have just adopted includes the filed sewer-only account special assessment report along with the collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax roll for fiscal year 2019-2020. This concludes the public hearing, and we will now return to the next item on the agenda. Okay. With that, we will go to the executive reports, Paul.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. My written report is included in your board package. Three items I'd like to briefly cover today. Yesterday, Jolene, Joe, and myself attended a meeting with the Chief of the Civil Works Integration Division for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers South Pacific Division. Just by background, the way the Corps is organized is they have districts, division, and then headquarters. Our local district is the L.A. district that includes Southern California, Southern Nevada, and most of Arizona, but the South Pacific Division actually includes a substantial portion of the western United States. So they include all of California, all of Nevada, all of Utah, all of Arizona, all of New Mexico, but also portions of Colorado and portions of Texas. So funding recommendations ultimately funnel through the South Pacific Division to headquarters. So having a relationship with the South Pacific Division, having them aware of your projects, and having them support the funding requests that you're putting forward are extremely important. So we met with Karen Beresford, who is the Chief of the Civil Works Integration Division, and the subject was the Paris 2 desalination program. I got an excellent meeting. She was very candid about where we stand. Right now, as you're aware, we have a Section 219 Corps of Engineers Environmental Infrastructure Authorization for $25 million for that project. We've obtained $20.3 million of the $25 million, and we're seeking the last $4.7 million to complete additional well and pipeline improvements associated with the desalters and the Paris II desalter that's under construction now. So we talked through that with her, got very positive feedback that they will be moving forward with seeking that remaining funding, and talked through that process with her. The other subject was we are looking to modify our existing authorization for $25 million to add an additional $25 million to that through a process that is in place that allows an authorization of that or a modification of that authorization. The first part of that project is to be in the Corps' annual report as a recommendation from the headquarters that they're supporting that authorization modification. The annual report came out late this spring, and we were included in that for an additional $25 million. The $25 million will be used to do additional wells, as well as to fund a potential brine recovery treatment facility that we're looking at. And as you know, we're doing pilot work on that right now at the desalters. But the next step in the process will be required that Congress basically reauthorizes that and includes that modification in an upcoming WRDA, Water Resources Development Act bill that's currently in negotiation in Congress. So we talked through that process with her as well. She gave us some counsel on what we need to have as far as documentation to support that action through Congress. And we're going to keep that critical guidance and move forward on this. But anyway, I thought it was a very big step. The timing is particularly good for this meeting. I think our relationship with the South Pacific Division has really paid dividends in the past. And I think that was very, was certainly the invitation we had in the meeting yesterday. Under past and ongoing activities, our bill, SB 414, passed out of its last policy committee last week in advance of the legislative deadline. So the Small System Water Authority Act was voted out of the Assembly Local Government Committee on a 7-1 vote. Danielle Coates testified on behalf of the district, as well as Danielle Blassett from CMUA, did a great job in that testimony. The one vote against the bill basically came as a result of, we think, some misunderstanding and mischaracterization in the Assembly Republicans' consultant report, which basically implied that the bill would provide some new taxing authority that municipal water districts typically don't pass. We think there's a misunderstanding there. So we're going to loop back with the Republican consultant prior to going to the floor and get that clarification put in their report. But all in all, that's moving forward very well. It's now in the Appropriations Committee before the recess. A key constraint to getting the bill approved is, in my opinion, a need to get the State Water Resources Control Board in support of the bill. They've hung back. We've heard through communications to the administration that they do not like the bill for a variety of reasons. We've attempted to engage them actually for 2 years now since we did AB 2050 on what particularly amendments they'd like to see in the bill, and we're just not getting that feedback. We have had a little breakthrough on that, however, and we do have a meeting set up with the State Water Resources Control Board's senior staff and legal counsel to discuss the bill on July 25th. So we are going to meet with them on July 25th and see if we can get to the bottom line on what amendments they might like to see in the bill to make it acceptable to the board, such that when the bill, or if the bill gets out of the legislature and goes to the governor's office, that we wouldn't have a threat of veto. So that's moving forward very nicely, but we still have, I think, a big milestone here. We need to get over to the state board.
Paul, what's the status of Laurel Firestone's approval to be on the
board? Her appointment's not been confirmed.
Okay. I'm hearing that there might not be a slam dunk. here and there.
I think that's probably a good characterization.
Okay.
I think, and that's why it has not been confirmed today. Other items the board might be interested in. We have a really great initiative we are just engaging in with Cal Poly Pomona. The district's entered into a partnership with their College of Engineering to provide a couple of things, research support activities, as well as student internship opportunities, both with graduate and undergraduate students. A key project we're getting them involved in will be related to our purified water replenishment project, our indirect potable reuse project that we will be proposing to construct at the San Jacinto plant. Part of the challenge of that project is the brine, because the brine line is terminates at the Inland Empire Energy Center and does not go out all the way out to the San Jacinto plant. We're using reverse osmosis technology to treat the water that we will use for groundwater replenishment. So brine management is a challenge, and we've looked at different opportunities to treat the brine, including brine drying and different things. But as you know, we've been piloting brine treatment technologies for our desalters. But now what we want to do is look if we can use that same brine treatment technology and apply it to recycled water that would be put through the reverse osmosis system for our indirect potable reuse project. So when we're done with the desalters with that Desalitech technology, we are going to move it out to the treatment plant at the San Jacinto plant and set up a pilot program out there on the recycled water. So Cal Poly is going to support that. They put a full scope of work together. We're going to have faculty involved in it, as well as graduate students. They'll be coordinating with us on the installation operations and testing of the pilot brine treatment system, and then they're going to provide us a completed report on the pilot program for our use. So it's a, and we're funding this, obviously, it's a funding partnership, but we really think it's a great opportunity to bring in really one of the preeminent engineering schools in the nation, and also to attract and recruit some of their top students for potential employment with NWD.
So you're a little biased on that, aren't you?
Joe and I are a little bit, but all Cal Poly universities.
I'll grant you that.
Okay. All right. Anyway, so it's a really great partnership. I think after we get it up and running a little bit, we'll report back to the board. But we're really pleased. The university's been really eager to do this, and I think we're going to get some great support and really have a good relationship and recruiting pipeline for Eastern. Anyway, that concludes my report. Any questions?
Sounds terrific.
Thank you.
Okay. Laura?
I have one item. With the board's approval of the CIS implementation project last meeting, I'm excited to announce that we're having a soft kickoff this week. We have our AAC partners, our project managers, and the CIS and software company on site working with our core team this week to kick off the project. So they're raring to go and get going on this project. So we'll be bringing it back a report to the board within the next 6 months on an update to give you the status of where we're at and if we're encountering any challenges. And we're really excited about getting going, and I appreciate the approval.
Nick?
Yeah, I'd like to share one update. It's on a project that we've been very closely engaged with the local community. That's our Well 203 project. This is a new well project out in the area of San Jacinto, and it's on a relatively small site that we own. Neighbors are immediately surrounding the site, so we've been working very closely with them, reaching out as far as what the project entails and staying engaged as the work goes on. As you know, with projects like this, there's 24/7 operations associated with the drilling and the mechanical development. Good news is the project is on schedule, back a little bit ahead of schedule. We've completed the well drilling, which entails a pilot hole and two reaming passes over about a 2 to 3 week period. We're now in the mechanical development phase. This is still 24-hour operation, so we're still very much engaged with the community. But the project's on schedule. The community seems to be very aware of what the process is and supportive of our efforts, but we're continuing that dialogue. Very shortly, we'll continue with well development, which will entail groundwater blow-off, and we'll be utilizing storm drainage facilities in the community to discharge that flow. But pleased to say that everything is on schedule, and it seems like the relationship with the community is good and very supportive of what we're doing.
Appreciate the efforts on that.
Good. All right. Joe.
Good morning. Just one item, Dr. Sullivan. As the board is aware, we have a cooperative agreement with the US Air Force to advance treatment for Well 59, which is located immediately south of the Marshall Reserve Base. I'm pleased to report that the design effort for the wellhead treatment has been completed, and we will be advertising the project for construction dates starting next week. Upon receipt of bids, we will be coming back to the board in September to make our recommendation for an award contract. That project, as you're aware, is funded by the U.S. Air Force through that cooperative. That's all.
Okay. With that, we'll go to agenda item.
Turned the wrong page. Yeah. Agenda item 4, which is the consent calendar, to accept a motion and a second for approval of agenda items 4A through 4E, unless any director wishes to pull one.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Go to agenda item 5, which is the action calendar. Agenda item 5A. Adopt two resolutions establishing assessment districts, community facilities, special taxes, and general obligation bond tax rates on the property tax rolls for fiscal year 2019-2020. Charles.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone. Since this is our annual item for bringing forward to the district our community facility districts, assessment districts, and general obligation bond tax rates bring on the property tax rolls. We have our entire team here today. I want to thank all of them for our work in the last several months and gathering this data. As the board is well aware, the district has an active role in finding funding sources for a variety of our programs. We use many tools to be able to serve that purpose in developing our community and building it in a fair and equitable way. One of those tools that we use is a community facility district or assessment districts, and we also use general obligation bonds from time to time. And those funding sources help in sharing those costs as well in a fair and equitable way. What we'll bring to you today is our proposed tax levy for each of those communities. There's a variety of reports that are associated with it. And I just wanted to just highlight a few of the components to it. We, as part of our levy each year, we're required to ensure that the payments of those taxes are used for the payment of our debt service as well as for any ministerial costs associated with each community. There's an exhibit to this report, which details the levy summary, Exhibit B. Eastern is one of the larger issuers of CFP debt, so we do have a variety of communities, but there's an extensive listing here showing the details of each of the CFPs, the number of parcels levied, the amount to be levied related to this debt, and the levy built into last year. And so, in summary, the district is issuing for the community facility districts and assessment districts for over 22,000 parcels. That's a substantial portion of our community. And we've added over 2,000 parcels in the last year. So you can see we're growing, we're expanding our district. And as we do grow into those community facility districts, we're seeing additional onboarding of those properties into the levy. And because of that, we're increasing our levy for this next year. It's really driven because of those additional 2,000 parcels that are added to the community facilities. I want to highlight also, though, that we've been very successful in that our tax delinquencies this last year was very low, below 1%, and which is significantly credit to the strength of our community. And we do incorporate a component of any delinquency rate in our levy, and we're continuing to enjoy the benefits of the capital of delinquency rates in our CFDs. And I also just want to highlight, finally, our GO bonds. Those rates are based off of assessed values in the community. The taxes are based off of our debt service payments, and the debt service payments have matured yet. There's several reasons why that will happen. We're keeping them raised where they are today. As the debt services get paid off, we'll come back and we'll lower those GO bond tax rates. So in summary, I basically summarized, I think, yeah, 4 months worth of hard work in great detail, an unbelievable amount of spreadsheets. You know I like spreadsheets, but these guys really built some spreadsheets to go through all of this. I also want to highlight, though, the county has also gone through a big transformation in their operation system. They've moved their assessed value and all the data from one legacy system to a new system. We're able to provide all the data until, I don't know, really recently. They were able to pull all this together, do all the QAQC on the fly. It was an unbelievable effort. I really want to commend them for what they did this year, given the circumstances and the importance of this work. But it all, at the end of the day, comes back to a strong and encouraging level of effort for this group to be able to ensure that the tax rates are as low as possible and that people are paying fair and equitable prices for their service. So with that, that's my summary of our report. Our recommendation is to adopt the resolutions to put these on their draft rules. The county requires that we adopt this and bring it to them in August. They will then be brought onto their system, and then they'll be incorporated into the tax rules for the next fiscal year. Their tax bills will come in and they're due in December and April for their installments. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have about our reports and our recommendations.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. We go to agenda item 5B, which is approve and authorize the water supply assessment for the Mead Valley project in accordance with the provisions of Senate Bill 610 and Senate Bill 221. Gordon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm here to present the water supply assessment for the Mead Valley project. As listed in the resolution under Senate Bill 610 and 221, a water supply assessment is required for projects that meet certain criteria, size criteria under as part of the CEQA process. Usually that's because they're at or exceeding 500 dwelling units. In this case, it's the warehouse facility, and it's due to the size of the project, the amount of land, and also the floor area. So the Mead Valley project is in Mead Valley planning area. This water supply assessment was requested by Riverside County, and the project consists of 98 acres on a site that's located between Andina Avenue to the north, Oleander to the south, and it's west of Decker Road, which is west of the 215 freeway. So the 90-acre site consists of two light industrial warehouses, and the developer is the Ceres Regis Group. When we look at this area and our urban water management plan, the land use that we were anticipating was business park and light industrial use. So the demand that was considered in the urban water management plan was just over 240 acre feet annually. However, since this project is a warehouse, we now are significantly reducing the projected demand of this project, and we're anticipating that this project is only going to require about just over 60 acre feet annually. It's demand, so this is well within the limits that were accounted for in our water management plan. And so, with that, we would like to recommend that we approve and authorize this water supply assessment for the Mead Valley project.
Okay. Got any questions?
I'll move approval.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Gordon. With that, we'll go to the information items 6A. Good morning.
Just before we get started, we talked in the last board meeting in my board report. I mentioned this item with respect to what was going on from the regulatory standpoint at the state, what we're seeing in Orange County and other places, and as well as the state and federal legislation that's forthcoming. So what we wanted to do with today's presentation is give the board a very thorough background on per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, what their impacts are to water quality, what the regulatory framework is. what we're seeing in our service area and on the state and federal legislation. So we have a multi-staff panel that will present this item today in the, on the different components. And Linnea has kind of led this effort, and so she's going to go ahead and kick off.
All right.
And members of the board, thank you for this opportunity to present this update and associated water quality issues. As Paul mentioned, we have a very jam-packed agenda, starting with an overview of PFOA and PFOS. Also, some terminology that's commonly used when discussing PFOA and PFOS, regulatory actions, monitoring that Eastern has conducted to date, in addition to some updates on the specific impacts on the March Air Force Base, federal and state legislation, and EMWD's current response and planned future responses. Because this is such a jam-packed agenda, we will be pausing throughout to allow for questions, but please feel free to answer or ask questions as we go as well. So PFAS refers to per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances. That is a broad and catch-all term for a class of man-made industrial compounds. These chemicals are they're water resilient, but that also makes them very stable and persistent in the environment and also potentially risky to human health. There's over 4,500 of these PFAS chemicals, but of these chemicals, PFOA and PFOS are the most extensively manufactured and have been the most analyzed for regulatory standards. PFOA and PFOS have been widely used by American manufacturers from the 1940s until they were phased out in the early 2000s. The water repellent properties of these compounds made them very popular for use in stain-resistant carpet, fabrics, and other stain-resistant products. Also in water-resistant clothing and in food packaging. They also were used for the manufacturing of Teflon cookware, as well as very widely used in foam firefighting foam. Now, although they've been phased out by many American manufacturers, these are still manufactured overseas and can be imported via consumer goods from other parts of the world.
Can I ask one of those annoying questions?
Of course.
What is, if they were phased out, what was phased in to take their place?
other of those 4,500 PFAS compounds.
Okay.
So perhaps we can elaborate that. The original PFAS manufactured at CA was a long chain. Constituent. The replacement is a much shorter chain, which is more ubiquitous.
Gotcha. Okay. So there was a substance. So technology found new solutions, basically.
But to Linnea's point, they're still used overseas.
Okay.
And as we know, we don't really import anything from any other parts of the world using the United States. So, but it really gets to, you know, the overall regulatory structure with respect to the use of these in goods and human exposure paths that's still out there.
Gotcha. So it's... Is it? It's not banned then.
It's not. It is not banned. As I mentioned, there was voluntary kind of acceptance to phase out the long chains, but they are not banned. They are getting a lot more attention. Just yesterday morning on my way in, I heard an article on NPR about New Hampshire. Look at this. New Jersey already has established. Level, so it is becoming more and more prevalent in the media, and I will be hearing much more about it as we move forward. So we all have been exposed to PFAS through these consumer goods, but it's also, as I mentioned, very persistent in the environment. It's found in soil, it's found in the air, it's found in surface water and groundwater, also in landfills, wastewater sludge, and because of all of these different ways that we've been exposed to it, if we were tested, most of us would show up in most of us in terms of our blood. There was a test that was done, and 95% of the people that were tested showed levels of PFAS in their blood. There is evidence that this exposure can lead to adverse health impacts. the Science Advisory Board to the U.S. EPA, as well as the World Health Organization, considers PFOA a, quote, likely human carcinogen. However, the most supporting evidence for health risk is on higher risk, higher increased levels of cholesterol in the exposed population, with much more limited research on some of these other health impacts like cancer and others that are listed here, infertility issues, liver damage, and so forth. When we talk about levels of PFAS, we talk about them in terms of parts per trillion. I think Paul used this, this analogy last time as well. A part per trillion, or PPT, is often compared to a single drop in about 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. I think one of the other reasons that we have seen more of this in the news and it's becoming more prevalent in terms of the discussions is because our detection levels and the analytical tools that we have available to us are much more advanced. And so people are looking at trying to get lower and lower because of as the technology advances for these detection levels. Now, one thing that's important to note that in California, we do not have any established regulations for PFOA or PFAS. Now, when for what's enforceable is an MCL. That has not been established either at the federal or the state level. Nor has California established a public health goal, which often leads to an establishment of an MCL in the state. What has been established are some non-enforceable standards, including a health standard that has been established by the federal EPA, which recommends that water agencies, should this become apparent or detected, notify local agencies as well as consumers, and can consider taking the source out of service, providing treatment, or blending it with another source to get below the health advisory level. The state has established a response level for PFOA and PFOS. Again, it's non-enforceable, but does recommend taking the source out of service if those levels are exceeded. The state has also established a notification level for the combination of PFOA and PFOS, which again is a non-enforceable standard that indicates that the source can remain in service, but in this case, it's highly recommended that associated governing bodies and consumers be notified of the levels. And Al is going to get into more of what those levels are and what we found in our sources.
Thank you. So in January of 2009, EPA issued the provisional health advisories. For PFOA, that was 400 parts per trillion, and for PFOS, that was 200 parts per trillion. Just recently in May 2016, EPA lowered that with a health advisory and utilized a combination of PFOA and PFOS at 70 parts per trillion. Just recently, the state, in July 2018, issued a response level, which was equivalent to the EPA health advisory of the combined PFOA and PFOS of 70 parts per trillion. They also issued a notification level for PFOA at 14 parts per trillion and PFOS at 13 parts per trillion. If we look across the United States, as I mentioned, there are 10 states that have enforceable standards. The rest are non-enforceable. The ones that are highlighted or in color are usually locations that they have detected PFAAs at military installations or manufacturing locations. So what Paul had mentioned last board meeting was the concern that we have for response and notification levels that are being proposed. The notification level, this is from the state, the notification level for PFOA goes from 14 down to 5.1. For PFOS, it goes from 13 to 6.5 parts per trillion. And in the response level, it actually drops to for PFOA, 10 parts per trillion, and for PFOS, 40 parts per trillion. So we have been monitoring for PFAS or PFOA and PFOS There were two mandatory required monitorings. The first one was in 2013. EPA required us to do an unregulated contaminant monitoring rule for UCMR 3, where we monitored all of our source water. The other one was just recently, in March of 2019, the state issued a PFAS-based investigation. This is phase one. There were specific conditions that we had to do monitoring, and we issued an order to us. For UCMR 3, the purpose was to collect data from the source water, assess monitoring, and determine a regulatory action. For EMW, again, we monitored all our sources, which was the water filtration plants, the desalter, and some treated wells, and as well as the wells. It should be noted that the detection levels here are at 20 and 40 for PFOA and PFOS. This is higher than either the notification level or proposed notification level or response level. For the state PFAS-based investigation approach, there were three phases that are going to be issued. The first one we received in March of 2019, centered around airports, landfills, and already indicated UCMR 3 water sources that had indications of PFAS in there. Phase two is the manufacturing facilities. And then phase three are discharges to wastewater, as well as the wastewater treatment plants. Now, the order that we received required us to monitor seven of our wells. In each valley, that was four, and in the desalter wells, there were three. The ones in these valleys was identified because they were near a landfill or historical landfill locations. The desalter wells actually had PFAS indications before. Additionally, EPA in February developed an action plan and published this. This outlines steps to address PFAS and protect the public health. This includes cleanup strategies, monitoring, research, enforcement activities, risk communication, and finally, determining an NCL.
Al, before you move forward, could you flip back to slide 13? Sorry,
Oops.
In closing, no.
Yeah.
There you go. This was what I referred to in my GM's report at the last meeting, and the Department of Drinking Water was considering publishing these revised notification and response levels on July 8th.
Yes.
As I mentioned, we were working with other agencies to have that deferred, and that was deferred. Department of Drinking Water, through State Board Cal EPA, have said they are going to look at deferring those to maybe the notification level in July and perhaps a response level sometime in the fall, and giving us an opportunity to be able to look at the studies that are being done to support this. So I just wanted you to keep these in mind. These were proposed. It was very imminent. It looks like we're going to get a little bit of time, but those proposed notification and response levels have not put in to date. But we are anticipating those in this fall, certainly by this fall. Anyway, sorry about that.
Yeah,
I forgot to mention
that. Yeah. Yeah. So monitoring results. So for the UCMR 3, we had these sources be tested, and they were all less than 20 and 40 parts per trillion, or PFOA and PFOS. There are 15 locations that indicated that they were below those levels. Recently, from our order, these are the results that we have, PFAS results. So for the East Valley wells, you can see that we're all below the less than 2. Again, for the new methods that they're issuing or requiring us to do, the method came from down from 20 down to 2 for PFOA, for PFOS from 40 down to 2. So there's a big change in the detection level for those methods. If you look at the desalter wells, again, they indicate that they have a presence of PFOA and PFOS. However, remember that these are desalter wells that go through an RO before it gets to the public. And so they are treated. You can see that lower level there below the notification levels.
So that's the effluent that is coming out of the desalters at less than 2 to 3.3 and less than 2 to 2.7. And the reason there is any presence of the PFAS, PFOA, and PFOS in the effluent is because a portion of the water is blended and not put through the desalter. So we bypass a portion of it for economic reasons. And so that's why you're seeing some presence. But you can see there's very substantial removal of the PFOA and PFOS by the reverse osmosis facilities.
So just in perspective, where the locations are, to the east is where well 17, 36, and 34 are located. The other ones, the desalter wells, are in Nuevo and Lakeview and located here, where it goes to our treatment here. To the south and at all the lower levels for them to give you an idea where these are located. So, March, any questions we have here? Okay, March Air Force Command Tax. For March Air Force Base, the PFAS for PFOA and PFOS was used at Site 7 as a firefighting foam in a training location, now March Air Force Base. Well 59, as well as two private wells, has been reported to the EPA with help of above the health advisories. And because of this, these were shut down in May 2016. Well 56 was detected above the stage notification level, and that was shut down in February of 2019. So we have been working with March Air Force Base on this PFOA PFOS issue. The first one we have is an Environmental Service Cooperative Agreement, or ESCO-1. This was a reimbursement for the imported replacement water and for two water service connections. We also work with them on an ESCO-2. This one was the design and construction of the treatment system, one that Jill was talking about, that we're going to have construction support. Currently, we're going to go into negotiation with ESCO-3, which will be the treatment system, operation, and maintenance. In addition, Eastern also sent the Air Force a letter stating that Well 56 was removed from the service, and we requested remediation negotiation on that, but was denied from the Air Force. However, they did agree to a tolling agreement, which we are currently working with them on right now. Lastly, Air Force is conducting a PFOA and PFOS delineation study to determine the extent of March Air Force Base impacts in the area and groundwater.
One thing I might want to comment on, or you might want to comment on, is the concentrations. I saw the map under the March Air Reserve Base, and I think there's some areas where it's over 10,000 parts per million in the shallow groundwater. Under the March Air Reserve Base. So, you know, we're talking about parts per trillion at very low levels. They're seeing 10,000 parts per trillion under the firefighting area. So, obviously, you know, we're concerned in the long term about the impacts off the base, and I think that's why the Air Force is conducting their plume delineation study at this point.
For regional and local PFOA and PFOS activities, the following agencies, we reached out to see what they were doing. For City of Corona, they issued an order for all their wells to be tested, as well as they had been conducting voluntary testing. The other ones have been doing voluntary testing with Western Municipal Water District, only had one well, and not doing either the order or the voluntary. The local agencies, we did reach out. We have no response, except yesterday we did get a response from San Jacinto. They indicated that they do not have an order requirement, or nor are they going to do any voluntary testing. So one thing to know is Orange County Water District does have an issue with PFOA and PFOS. They were ordered to test 53 of the wells from 12 Orange County Water District pumpers. And they're estimating that about 71 out of 200 wells in Orange County Water District would exceed the proposed response level. That equates to about 100,000 acre-feet of groundwater production that will be impacted, which probably will have to be supplemented by MWD for imported water. Orange County Water District also has the only public agency testing lab that's certified for PFOA and PFOS. They conducted testing in the upper Santa Ana River with dischargers, and then they also did testing of the river. Now, the key thing about this is they used the Santa Ana River for so that's why we're rejecting upstream project funding from Santa Ana Group. Their actions, they issued a template letter to the water producers to give those to board members as well as electric officials, which stated PFAS occurrence in the Santa Ana River can be explained at least in part through the presence of PFAS in upstream treated wastewater discharge. Again, reminding that they're saying that the groundwater is being recharged by Santa Ana River. They also issued a letter to upstream Santa Ana River discharge, including us, on June 6, 2019, stating that they clearly demonstrate that the POTW discharge are a source of PFAS. They also encourage us to participate in Southwest Emergency Constituent Task Force study, or EC Task Force, in August. We have participated in the EC Task Force previously during the time of the emerging constituents. For several years that we did testing with them. And so we are going to conduct that same similar testing of emerging constituents in addition to the PFAS, PFOA, PFOS.
So, Al, do we have something in our brine?
Brian, we haven't tested our brine, so it's probably going to be because it's concentrated in there. We're removing it from the brackish water that we're putting into our RO. The brine will probably be concentrated. That we haven't tested for concentration.
Because the brine line doesn't go to the river.
No.
No, it's bypassed plant, goes to plant 2, Orange County, OCSD plant 2, and then is blended with the balance of the outfall discharge and put into the 5-mile outfall.
Okay. Should add that volumetrically, the brine is a very small fraction of what Orange County's treatment plants actually sees as effluent. Our discharge from the 2 desalters currently is about less than 1 MGD per day of brine. The brine line has a capacity of 30 MGD, and of course the wastewater plant which currently sees a much, much greater flow than the brine line. So we can look at the loadings, but it's a very...
Right. Ours would probably be minimal. My understanding from Orange County was when they tested the river from the outfalls that they were at 37 to 39. Which is
from the POTW plant. Discharges in the main stem of the Santa Ana River.
Correct.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's correct. But the brine again is being bypassed. And then we have some information kind of on our discharges here, and I think we want to think about what our relative contribution is, and we think it's very nominal, if anything.
Right.
So, and that's what this chart slide shows.
Yeah, we do discharge to the Santa Ana River to Temescal Creek. As Paul mentioned, it is nominal. From 2014 to 2018, we only intermittently discharged. Actually, we only discharged 1 year in 2017. The total discharge is about 2,899 acre feet, or about 1.3% of the recycled water produced during that time period. Again, where we discharge at Temescal Creek is about 21 miles from Santa Ana Main Street. So there's some time before you can get there, and usually when we do discharge, it's during the wet season too, so we have a lot of pollution that's also added to that. We did not test our discharge, but we did test our wastewater treatment plants, and the results are here. They all indicate that they're less than 24 PFOA and PFOS. There is an asterisk on the Paris Valley treatment plant. That sampling on 616 did show results of 22 PFOA and 138 PFOS. But the resample, when we did it again, showed that those less than 20 were less than 40. The reason for that increase was unknown at this time. Questions? And with that, I'm going to bring it up. Thank you.
So, as the legislature does, they have elected to also weigh in on this issue, both at the state and federal level. I'm going to cover the state portion, and we'll come to the major assessments that are the federal response. So Eastern is, we facilitate weighing in on this issue through our board adopted policy principles and legislative priorities. Our legislative priorities require or look to a more scientifically developed response to water quality issues.
And then also peppered throughout both documents is a local control in terms of how we respond to various issues. So again, that's how we intend to use the documents that we have to communicate our response to the legislature. The state legislature this year introduced two bills through the assembly process. Assembly Member Team introduced AB 841, and that was a more measured approach that looked to have OEHA develop a work plan, and the work plan would assess various elements. This bill was held in its policy committee last week. It did not make it out in time for the deadline, likely in deference to the Department of Drinking Water effort and those efforts of the State Board. Conversely, Assemblymember Christina Garcia introduced AB 756, which looked to develop a more robust and extensive notification procedure for those public water agencies that did not take a water source that had an identified response level for PFOA or PFOS. That extensive notification procedure required, in addition to CCR inclusion, requires the water provider to send a letter to each and every one of its customers, regardless of their proximity to the well with the identified PFOS. It also required the notification to go out to all retail and wholesale customers. There was extensive notification that had to be done through the website, through social media, in the newspapers, and a lot of this is coming in advance of the scientific data that we will need to really thoroughly inform our constituents of the issue. So Christina Garcia's bill did pass out of the legislature last week and is awaiting signature by the governor, where we fully anticipate that the governor will sign this bill. So that's what I have on the state side, just up on federal.
Good morning. On the federal side, over 35 bills have been introduced to date. Last week when we started this presentation, there were only 30, so it seems to be changing by the day, but at this point we're at 35. There are two key bills that we have our eye on at the moment that seem to be moving very quickly. They're both must-pass bills that will make it to the president's desk in some form or another. The first one on the Senate side is S-1790, the National Defense Authorization Act. And this bill requires, in terms of the PFOS provisions, it requires EPA to set a primary drinking water standard within 2 years with a 5-year grace period for enforcement. It requires public utilities to test all tap water. It adds PFOS, a variety of PFOS chemicals, to UCMR5. Al mentioned the kind of predecessor to that. It requires the Department of Defense to phase out firefighting foam with PFOS by the year 2023. Manufacturers would be required to report when they have spills of PFOS into either the air or water, which they're not currently required to report. And then it requires USGS, or the U.S. Geological Survey, to test all of the nation's rivers, lakes, and streams for PFOS compounds. There were many more onerous provisions introduced or proposed, but the Senate could not get the 60 votes needed to pass the more onerous provisions. However, on the House side, they did get the votes to pass pretty much all of the provisions that are in the Senate bill, in addition to a number of very onerous provisions. Some of these include requiring firefighters to have their blood tested, again, ending the use of firefighting foam by 2025. Also requires the DOD to share all of their monitoring data, so all of the well monitoring data from all the bases would be made public. It also requires DOD to discontinue the use of PFOS in their ready meal packages, which apparently they have a high concentration of currently. The very most problematic and onerous provision would be the required listing of PFOS as a hazardous substance under CERCLA or Superfund. So worst case scenario for that would be say your biosolids have a high concentration of PFAS, all the land where those biosolids would be landified could be considered Superfund sites. The next step is for the House and Senate to conference these two bills. There's no way they have the votes to get most of these onerous provisions through to the president. If they do, the president has already been very clear that he will veto these bills if they come to him with these provisions, both the hazardous waste provision as well as the provisions that, from his perspective, single out the Department of Defense. The committee of jurisdiction for all of this PFAS issue is actually the Energy and Commerce Committee. They are developing a bipartisan package also addressing PFAS. If these issues weren't picked up in the NDAA, this would be the committee that would address this. So they're also developing their own package. That's all I have. And we're moving on to our response.
Yeah, unless there's questions on the state and federal legislation. I think of all the federal bills, the H.R. 2500, which, as Jolene explained, has some of the most onerous provisions. One of the things that's in there is that requiring listing PFAS as hazardous substance under CERCLA and saying basically any place that has PFAS, for example, where we deliver our biosolids to in Arizona would be a Superfund site. That's going to be problematic. I mean, that is a huge, huge impact, basically saying they're regulated under CERCLA. So we're hoping and we believe that provision will likely come out because it could have some very very substantial implications to our biosolids and the manner in which we dispose our biosolids. Any other questions on the federal legislation or state legislation for Danielle or Jolene? I know we're cheering you up quite a bit with this presentation. Comments on that? Questions? Okay. I think the last part of this, and this is the last part we promise, is we really want to go over kind of what are our proposed actions? What are we going to do? What do we have in motion, and what are we proposing as an organization to address this? So Al's going to wrap up with that.
So we're going to continue with our district current response to PFOA and PFOS detection and source of water. Currently, we remove the source from service of PFOA and PFOS detected and received response and notification levels. And we have done this with well 59 as well as well 56 at the time. This is consistent with our district's strategic priorities, which is to ensure all water supplies protect the health and safety of the community. One thing we want to do is make sure we preserve our district brand when we're doing this, and also to ensure confidence in customer confidence in EMWD and our actions that we do. We also are going to implement an enhanced monitoring program. We have added or will add additional customer outreach on this item, and also we'll actively engage in regional collaboration in informing regulations. So for enhanced monitoring, we are in the process of conducting PFOA, PFOS monitoring on all our supply sources that are not already tested under state order. These are additional 26 samples that we're going to do. They'll be, again, sampled over this next month. They include, again, wells, the water treatment plants, and the desalter. The cost for these are $447 for the 26 sample locations that we're planning to do. That's $11,622. We'll also conduct the effluent monitoring as required by the state investigative study for phase three. We anticipate that at the end of 2019. We'll also develop or have are in process of developing a fact sheet and frequently asked questions. This will be posted online for consumers. For regional collaborations, we're going to participate again with the SAPA EC Task Force or Emerging Constituent Task Force in August of 2019. This again is the effluent monitoring for PFOA and PFOS. We'll have a partnership with Orange County, OCWD, IEUA, San Bernardino Valley Municipal Water District, Western Municipal Water District to develop a report that incorporates the best available science to inform state regulatory process. We've retained an expert on this toxicity and risk from Intertox. We're looking at some of the clinical studies from other states that have been used for the basis of regulatory actions. We're going to review that voted study from OEHA that was the basis of the response level. And then overall, the study cost is $48,000, so each of the participating agency, it costs will be $12,000.
And this will be completed this summer. The idea is as the state reconsiders the response level this fall, what we wanted to do was look at every state and their regulations that they've put in place and the health effects studies that they've used for those regulations. So Intertox will do a national search of the best available research and provide that and summarize that to help the state come up with a response level that's more appropriate. The response level they were proposing for that July 8th they deferred would have been the lowest in the nation. And so we're saying there's a lot better studies out there and an additional number of studies that have been critiqued and peer-reviewed that should be used as the basis for state coming up with a response level. And then, as Al mentioned, the second part of Intertox's work is to review the single rodent study that's being used by OEHA as the basis for the lower state levels. Interestingly enough, all that's available from that study to date is the data tables. There is no study written up. There's no description of how those data tables were interpreted to come up with the proposed response level. So that we feel that study has some fairly substantial inherent weaknesses. I met with the general managers of the other four SAPA agencies, and we agreed on this strategy. Orange County Water District, because of their background, is going to take the lead on the Intertox contract, and they're taking that to their board tonight.
You also might want to mention on the rodent study, it has not even been peer-reviewed.
Yeah, the rodent study hasn't been peer-reviewed either. So we think that, you know, we want to kind of stand on credible science, and we think this is the way to do it, is kind of look at the best information that's available. Thank you, Al.
That concludes our presentation.
So are there any questions on this? I know it's a lot, but we certainly wanted to give you kind of the full picture of what's going on. And also just see if there's concurrence with the board on kind of our strategy moving forward, particularly in two areas. One is that when we're seeing wells above the response or notification level, we're going to take those sources out of service. Again, there's been fairly few, just the three wells that we have right now around the March Air Reserve base. But we feel that's important so we can communicate with our customers that even above the notification levels, we're taking those wells out. And, in fact, that will put us in a position where we don't have to do notification because we're not serving water above those levels. So that's the one thing. And then the second thing is, I'll discuss, we're going to monitor all of our water sources. So we're going to sample test and monitor all our water sources. Right now, we're not required to do that by the state. They have an order that we have to look at some of those water sources. We've done that. There's also this phased investigation that requires we look at the effluent. We're going to be ahead of the schedule on that. So we feel it's very important to fully understand every single water source that we have and what the levels of PFOA and PFOS are in those water sources. And if we do find a water source that's above the response or notification level, that we would take that out of service. The last thing we didn't mention in the presentation that's important is our imported water basically is non-detect. Metropolitan's water is non-detect for PFOA and PFOS. So that source of water is obviously not an issue. And as Al said, when we're seeing in the monitoring generally so far, and again, we have not done the detailed monitoring and testing, but it appears the East Valley is in pretty good shape. You know, we're not seeing levels out there at all of PFOA or PFOS in the limited monitoring that we've done. And it appears where we're really seeing it, not, you know, surprisingly, is right around the base and then the desalter wells. But again, fortunately, the desalter wells go in through the desalter. We're removing most of that with the RO system. So we feel that we're on pretty good ground, but we just want to do the comprehensive testing to make sure that we can, if we have a customer that calls up and say, have you tested every single one of your water sources, we can unequivocally say yes. Because right now we can't say that because we haven't had to because of the limit of the current orders. So I just want to make sure the board's comfortable with that strategy.
Yeah. We understand that the only way to resolve it is going to cost money.
Right.
So there is some funding in the defense bill, $50 million or something like that, if I recall, that I don't know whether we can tap that or not, but it's something that we might explore the next time that we're back there if we want to do something.
It's not clear we're going to have any costs associated with this.
No. This agency is the least affected of anybody in the watershed, from what we heard at SAPA.
I think the other thing we need to address finally, and we can conclude, is the letter from OCWD to us implying that the upstream discharges are impacting the Orange County Basin.
Right.
You know, they certainly put a shot across the bow on that. They showed monitoring charts of the river showing the levels of PFOA and PFOS in the river downstream of the dischargers that are discharging into the main stem, so it's Western Valley and IUA, consistent with the levels of PFOA and PFOS that they're seeing in the groundwater basin. If you look at their groundwater basin, the wells that are affected, that number of wells, they're all around in down gradient of the Anaheim Forebay. So they're saying, that's coming from up there, we're putting it into the ground, it's going into our wells. I think what we want to do is continue to look at our effluent, do the effluent sampling, and do some calculations that show what our relative contribution to that is going to be. Bear in mind, we discharge at Temescal Creek, 21 miles upstream of the rain stem, and there's a lot of hydrologic features in between there, Lee Lake, a bunch of other things that we're not convinced any of the trace amounts of PFOA and PFOS in our effluent are ever getting past. And so I think that's one of the things we want to do is kind of shore up our position with OCWD in case that gets a little bit out of hand.
But one of the things that they did discuss the other day was that over the last 15, 20 years, the amount of PFOS has actually gone down because we don't manufacture it basically anymore.
Right. So. Any other questions?
With that, let's take a 10-minute break.
Thank you.